Well, we'll be starting shortly just with our Koheles class today, following through the theme of Sukkos. And we'll start momentarily. And we'll start just after a brief audio check. We ask that once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. This will confirm for us that you're picking up the audio fine. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Doing well today.
Good.
Doing well. How you doing, Cal?
I'm sorry?
Cal is with you?
She is.
Okay. Good morning, Cal.
And Sean is with us as well.
Okay. Good morning to you, Sean, as well. Okay. So we're going to take up Koheles. And let's see where we are here. Okay, just give me one sec. Sound is okay?
Excellent.
Okay, good. Okay, we got a couple people joining us this morning. Rosora is joining us from Italy, and JHS. I'm not sure what NL is, but he or she has been joining me quite a bit. So good morning to both of you. And Kim is in Florida. And what we're taking up today, now, Koheles, Ecclesiastes, is a book which initially the rabbis did not want to, they wanted to actually hide it away, put it into storage. And so the masses wouldn't have it because it appears that there are contradictions and instances where King Solomon, who wrote it, seemed to be saying things that were against the philosophy of Torah. But I believe that the reason why they allowed it in is because since it concluded that at the very end that a person should follow the Torah, and that was his summation point, so for that reason they allowed it, which appears to indicate that even though there may be some apparent contradictions to the novice reader, nonetheless, a book is defined by how it concludes. At the conclusion that it arrives at, because a person is allowed to go back and forth and debate and to consider different ideas, and but in terms of having a book that's going to be part of the canon, the formal collection of works of the Torah and writings, which is this is part of the third section, which is writings, so it has to be something which is consistent with the theme of Torah. And he does conclude at the very end, and he says a kol nishma. He says, let's read to the end. All Right, at the very end he says, the last two verses, he says, the end of the matter, after all is heard, one should fear God and should guard his commands, for this is all of man. For all matters, all actions, God will bring to judgment anything that is hidden, whether it's good or whether it's evil. And then we repeat the previous verse one more time. We say, "This the end of the matter is that after all is heard, meaning after everything has been considered, so God should be feared and his command should be watched and kept, for this is all of man." But there is an interesting, you know, style the way the king speaks. He talks about, for example, let's see, give you an example here. Right. For example, if you take a look at chapter 9, verse 6. Okay, Chana, welcome to you as well, and good afternoon, I see, to Rosor. Okay, yes, it's later on over there. So just to take a look at verse 9:3. Okay, 9:3. Let me know when you have it.
Got it.
Okay, so it says here, this is an evil. B'chol shenasa, and all that happens, that occurs under the sun. And you see he says under the sun many times. Under the sun means on earth. Whereas he's limiting his critique to earth. Okay, and he says here's an evil that exists, that occurs on the earth. For one occurrence happens to everybody. And also the heart of man is evil. And there's foolishness in his heart. And he says, what do we say? Actually, we've got to go before that. Before that, he says, right, he says in 9:2, the verse before that, everything happens to all. There's one occurrence that happens to everybody, right? Whether a person's righteous or he's evil, or if he is evil, whether he is good and pure, whether he is impure, whether he sacrifices or if he doesn't sacrifice. Just like what happens to the good person happens to the sinner. Okay, so that means that the event that he's talking about is death. All right. So it's, what does it sound like to you when he says this? That one thing happens to all, whether the person is righteous or if he's wicked, if he's pure or impure, whether he sacrifices or whether he doesn't sacrifice. There's one event that happens to everybody. And he says, Zera, this is an evil. Okay. Rashi says, who is the tzaddik? Who is the righteous person that this happens to? This is Noach. Who is a Russia? Who is a wicked person that this happens to? It's Paro.
Can you elaborate on that? I'm a little confused by that.
I mean, to say that he's just giving examples of who good people are and who bad people are, but he says that there's something which happens which he looks at and he says it's an evil, and that is that death occurs to everybody. So it's a critique. So this is an
example. You're saying Noah was the good person and Pharaoh was the evil person.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Not sure why Rashi is using those two. He says, who's a good person? This is Moses. Who's a pure person? This is Aaron. Who's an impure person? These are the spies that spoke bad in the land. All right. And he says like this. He says, Rashi says a little bit further, he elaborates, and he says, these spoke the praise of the land, meaning some of the spies, right? And some of them spoke about spoke bad about the land. They derided the land. And then he says, "Elu amru gnusan." So elu nechtesu the aretz, elu nechtesu. So, but both parties did not enter the land. Now, what's going on? It doesn't seem to be. He's attacking. See, he's talking about justice over here, right? If you have to couch the statement, it's concerning justice. So how could it be that certain people spoke bad about the land and certain people spoke good about the land, right? But they both did not get into the land. It seemed to be there was one fate, whether you're good or bad. Okay?
Wow, wait a minute, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
That, like, apples, oranges, and kumquats, because... I mean, I agree with his point that all fate death, okay, and that seems to be a rhetorical issue he's asking about that. But in terms of, well, the spies didn't get to go into the land because they were evil, or spoke badly about it, and Moses, who was a great man, didn't get to go into the land, so everybody gets the same. I mean, he didn't get to go into the land for a completely different reason than they did, and so I don't think you can compare just the end result and say, well, there's no difference between them, because a whole lot of people did get to go into the land.
Yeah, true. But what about he has another point where he says, if you talk about exact justice, how could it be that you had a righteous and a wicked people who both met with the same fate? He's still saying that is a question.
With regard to going into the land, or with regard to death?
With regard to describe it? Any justice. You should always have a distinction in justice for wicked people and the righteous. You should never have a case where both parties get the same result. This is just an example of that. It's just an illustration of his point.
Okay. So I'd make a couple of counterpoints. First of all, I mean, it's axiomatic that everybody on the earth dies. I realize there's a few exceptions out there, but generally speaking. So to say that that's the sum total, well, if everybody dies, then everybody gets the same fate, ignores two things. It ignores what happens after death. But importantly, it ignores the quality of the life that they have while they're here. So the wicked person, yeah, he meets the same, same death as, in a way, as the righteous person. But the quality of the life he had here is in no way even close to the quality of the life of a righteous person.
It's definitely true, but there is this opinion. And again, it's not something which King Solomon is agreeing with. I brought this up just to show you that this was one of the reasons why the rabbis had a problem. It sounds like he's voicing his own opinion, but he doesn't. He says later on, he makes it clear, let's see where it is, an example. Because he says, but I say, like for example, in 9:16, and I say, better is wisdom than strength. And this is actually what we're going to take up, is 9:16 to the end. So it's 9:16, 17, 18 is what we're going to take up. Okay. So the point is, though, that he voices an opinion, but he does this because he first wants to vocalize for the reader the opinions that people have, and what humans have. And some humans have this view where they assess the value of everything based only on earthly existence. That's why also, look at his words. He says there's an evil which is under the sun. Okay? What does that mean to say? It means that, again, here in 9:3, he says, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. Meaning, he's telling you that it's only an evil if your assessment is limiting man's existence to earth. In that case, so what good is it to be righteous or evil if everybody ends the same? If that's the complete end of man, then it's a question. But of course he has to teach what the truth is. But I think that's why he says over here that under the sun, if you frame man's existence and you limit it to his earthly stay, then you have a very good point. So where's the justice if you have a wicked person and a good person having the same exact fate? There's one other case where he talks about this more. He talks about, let me just think for a second, where was it? Justice? This person? Yeah. If you see that the righteous people have lousy lives and wicked people have good lives. That's another question. Meaning here we're talking about where both parties have an equal life. So that's, of course, a question. The good person should have a better life. But let's say when it's even worse, when you see the wicked people living in peace and tranquility and luxury, and the righteous people are not. Right? That even strengthens the question, doesn't it? You could definitely see that as being a question that people would ask.
Right. If you look at externals.
Yeah, but evidently, I mean, I think this is even a question that Moses had on God. He said, how is it that the righteous have evil in their life and then the wicked are living luxurious lives? As we see, tzaddik v'ra'lo, a tzaddik and he's met with evil, and rasha v'tovlo, and a wicked person that has good. So, but that's only a question if we limit the assessment of man's life to earth.
Well, and I could even argue that I can make an argument that you can argue that question even if you do limit man to just life on earth.
Go ahead.
Because we look at, let's take the righteous person who's poor and the wicked person who's got every luxury you can imagine. We look at the externals and we say, wow, the wicked person has it better. The question is, do they really? Well, because when you look at the life of wisdom and the internal peace that brings, I mean, the wicked are never internally at peace. They're always in conflict. We learn that from our studies of Mishlei. So even if they have all the luxuries, they will still be in conflict. And I think it's pretty safe to say that a righteous person who has very little would never look at a rich person and say, I'll trade and take, all their internal conflicts for the car and the boat and the condo and the Riviera.
Well, let's just talk about basic
questioning whether they in fact have a better life than the righteous.
Well, the fact is that if a righteous person did not sin at all, he is not going to be living in poverty. He'll be wealthy. Moses is wealthy. Abraham is wealthy. Isaac, Jacob. So it's only the righteous person that had some evils in his life that now justice demands that he is punished in this world and not in the next world. Because there has to be some.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's right. Rashi says it openly.
That a righteous person will be wealthy?
It's a blessing.
A righteous person will be wealthy?
And let's put wealthy. Let's say that first of all, Pirkei Avos does say that. Pirkei Avos says that if a person starts to learn in a state of poverty, he'll end up living in a state of wealth. And of course, wealth is defined in Pirkei Avos by being satisfied with your needs. But if you see somebody who's righteous, but he's living in poverty, so that has to be due to some sins. Because that would not be a just thing. If he didn't do anything wrong, then he should not be living in a state of deprivation. Meaning he shouldn't be feeling hungry. God created a person that they should, that their best state of mind is only when they're satiated, they have their needs, they have a roof over their head. But if you see somebody who's righteous and he's homeless and he has no food and he's sick constantly, so there has to be something that that's a response to. Because justice would not demand that a completely righteous person would be hurt. And King David says it, you know, throughout Psalms, that not one of his bones will be harmed. And maybe, you know, there are many evils. Seven, meaning many, many evils would commence to fall about on the righteous person, but God saves him from all of them. That means to say that the world has natural law, and there are evil people out there, but their attacks and schemes may be planned, and they may, you know, get a foot off the ground, but God will save the righteous person if he does not deserve to be hurt. So there's nothing that holds back God's justice from protecting a righteous person. And Maimonides in the Guide for the Perplexed talks about this. Depending on the level of the person's perfection and his right ideas of God, so that's how much more God's involved in his life, even to his mundane affairs, Maimonides says, even to his very mundane affairs. So it is a question. If you see that the righteous are having a miserable life and the wicked are having success. Right? Certainly the wicked should be punished and the righteous should be living without harm. But it's explained by there was some good that the wicked did, and that's why they're having some reward here. Right? That's their whatever reward they are owed, they're getting it here, and they will not get it in the next world. And the righteous, God wants them to have the best existence, that's the eternal existence. So that's the next world. So whatever they had not done repentance on, and they hadn't changed, and they still have a flaw, so that's something which God gives to them here. But of course, he gives them the punishment here in order to direct them towards what that flaw is, to think about it, to try to repent. So when we see this, though, on the surface, and you know, a typical person sees this, so then there's the question, and that's what King Solomon is doing over here. He's voicing the question, because this is what people have, but he voices it in order to bring it out into the foreground. Then he addresses it, because he has the answers in his book. But this is just one example. But I think also when he says under the sun, it hints to us that the question is only a question here on earth. Because if we look at death as being the end of man's complete existence, so then we wonder, how could it be that the wicked and the righteous are having the same exact end? How could it be that the wicked are successful and the righteous are being downtrodden? That's an even stronger question. So he brings this up because he's trying to educate the masses on the correct philosophies in all areas of life. Okay, and let me just see what Rosora just types up there on the screen, so let me just read what she's writing. She writes, "We cannot be sure a person is happier than another. We can only be sure of our happiness." Oops, looks like we're disconnected. Let's wait till the call back in. Okay, was that me? Did I hit something?
Well, I'm not sure. All of a sudden, you just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be pretty interesting if that did happen. But I was here the whole time, I guarantee you.
We're very glad for that.
Okay, I was just reading what Rosora was writing. She writes that we cannot be sure a person is happier than another. We can only be sure of our happiness, and so we cannot really compare. Material things don't bring happiness. In a just world, no one will be in a state of deprivation, and a righteous person needs little material things to be physically satisfied. Yes, that's true, Rosora. The only thing is we're just trying to understand is, I want to appreciate why King Solomon is making the statements that sound like there are injustices. So those injustices are something which would seem to be how people evaluate these matters. Of course, we're already after the point. We have the answer. We have the answer already, so it's hard to see the question. But if we could go back a step and appreciate what other people see in the world and who don't have the answer yet, you know, the people who don't have an answer yet, so they see the righteous that are not having a good life, and they see the wicked that are very successful. Or they see that, you know, if people don't have a concept of the next world and they just see that everybody dies, so what good is it to be righteous? Right, I think that's actually one of the words, one of the statements that King Solomon says in here. Let's see if I could show you another example. Second.
With us, Rabbi?
Yeah, I'm just looking for a there's one. 1 second.
That's fine. Just checking.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. 8:14. Chapter 8, verse 14. So he says there is a futility which occurs on the earth. Again, al ha'aretz, you see? He's talking about if we just look at the assessment of man based on earth. And he says there are some righteous people. And what reaches these righteous people is the occurrences that are akin to that should really be deserving of the wicked. And there are some wicked people that what reaches them is the occurrences that belong to the righteous. And I said that this is also futility. So when he says futility, it means it's a wrong idea. You can read it and you could say it's like life is worthless. So it sounds like on the surface that King Solomon is saying that, you know, God's system doesn't make sense. But you know, he's saying this is a hevel. It's a hevel in terms of how typical people look at it. Okay. Let's see. But if you look at 8:12, here's an example of where he talks about it. He expresses his own view. He says there is there's a sinner who does evil. How do you have that? Do you want to read that in English there, Doug?
Because a sinner does what is wrong 100 times, and he is patient, that he is Hashem.
Right, and God's patient with him. He doesn't punish him right away.
Right, yet Nevertheless, I am aware that it will be well with those who fear God, those that show fear before him.
Good. So you see, he says, that could be a question. How it could be that a person who does a sin 100 times, and God gives him time to repent, right? But Maruch Lo, on the surface, just means that he just allows him to continue. But King Solomon says, Ki gam yodea ani, but I know. So now he's verbalizing his own view. What's his view? It's good for the person to fear God. So you see, periodically he interdisperses his view. And he tells you what his ideas are throughout the Sefer, but it's back and forth. Okay, so you have to be sensitive to it, the way he approaches this. He's going back and forth between, but this verse here is a true. There's nothing really wrong in this verse. He's not really, he's not calling anything futility here, right? He says that there is a sinner, and he lasts a long time. He sins many times, 100 times, and God doesn't get rid of him. And again, of course, the commentaries are indispensable over here. You really have to see what they say. He says, God will not punish him right away. But he knows at the end that everybody will get the reward. Let me see what he says over here. Right, so he doesn't punish the wicked right away, but he does appear to punish the righteous right away. But that's for the good of the righteous, and it's also for the good of the wicked. The righteous will take heed right away, right? They'll give heed to God's punishments right away. So it's good that God will give the righteous person, you know, some sort of a punishment, so they can get him right on the track right away. But evidently, it's not going to be as constructive if he does the same to a wicked person. A wicked person needs time to learn that perhaps that negative things are a directive from God. So until he's learned that lesson, he won't look at the negative and he's anything. He'll just, you know, chalk it up to nature. He's not going to change his path. So God will not give a punishment until it's going to be received as such. Okay. Hey, let's take a look at the verses that I had planned to do over here. They are 9... starting with chapter 9, starting with okay 9:13. Let's take a look. This I've also seen, that wisdom under the sun is a great thing to me. There's a 14. You have, he says, there's a small city, and there are men in it that are few. And then there comes a great king, and he surrounds the city, and he besieges the city with a great fortress or a siege structure around the entire city. And then there's found, now we're to 15, there's found in this small city a poor man, but he's wise. And he saves the city with his wisdom. But no man remembers this man, this poor man. He's not remembered. Okay, 16, he says, but I say that wisdom is better than might. I say that wisdom is better than might, right? King Solomon says. But the wisdom of this poor man is despised, and his words are not even heard. Right? He's forgotten. Nobody recognizes him, even though he saves the city. Then he says the words of the wise, when they are delicately spoken or heard, when they're pleasantly spoken or heard, they're heard better than the cries of a foolish ruler. And the last verse is, better is wisdom than weapons of war. And a single sin can destroy much good. So of course what we have to do here is try to get the flow. What is he going on here? Certainly this last sentence. He just throws in this thing about a single sin can destroy much good. Up to this point, at least he's talking about, you know, rulers and the poor person, how he saved the city. But let's try to understand what this means. And Ibn Ezra says that certain commentators wanted to say that this was an analogy to the instincts and the intelligence of a person who was trying to, you know, just give an analogy to how you can have the city being like a person. And inside the city, this is like this wise man, that means the intelligence. And outside the city, you have this ruler that's evil, so that's the instincts. But the wisdom can conquer the instincts. But Ibn Ezra doesn't like that interpretation. He says, really, this should be taken literally. This is depicting an actual, you know, a very applicable rules that deal with cities and people and rulers. And to me, I agree with Ibn Ezra, because it's so obvious. We know this already, that the instincts are something that exists, and that there's intelligence in man, and that the intelligence can overrun them. So it seems like too obvious that King Solomon would have to make this statement. There has to be something greater here. Plus, there's a number of verses. So there's a lot going on. I mean, King Solomon, again, remember, when he was 12 years old, he became king, and God appeared to him in a vision and asked, he says, ask what I should give to you. So King Solomon asked for wisdom to judge the people. So God said back to King Solomon, since you didn't ask for the death of your enemies or for riches, but you asked for wisdom, I'm giving you all three. I'm not sure if there was a fourth, I don't recall. But what does it mean he's giving him all of them? I mean, if God is saying, since you didn't ask for riches and the death of your enemies, but you asked for wisdom, that means that you asked for the right thing. So the other things sound like they're incorrect. So why would God give him the death of his enemies and give him riches if these aren't the things that God preferred? No, that's not what it means. It means that since he had the right attitude and he had the priorities straight, that wisdom is the most important thing. So then God says, since you have the right priorities, so then you'll relate to riches and you'll relate to your enemies in the right way. So therefore I will give them to you. Because people, kings that just are seeking out the death of their enemies, they're looking for power. That's not what a king is supposed to be looking for. The king is supposed to be looking for ways to help people reach their perfection. So if a king's first request from God is, give me riches or give me the death of my enemies, that means he has the wrong value system. But King Solomon asked for wisdom to know how to judge the people, how to work with the people. So then he had the right attitude toward riches and the right attitude towards the enemies too, so therefore God gave him all of them. But God gave him a tremendous amount of wisdom that the kings and Queen of Sheba and people came from all over the world to hear his wisdom. And when the Queen of Sheba came there and she heard the wisdom of Solomon, so she said to him that what was told to me about your kingdom wasn't even half. I mean, she was completely overwhelmed. It was twice as much wisdom and greatness that she saw when she came to Jerusalem. So if that's the fact, so here we're reading King Solomon's words, we have to be looking for, you know, great treasures in every one of his verses. So just to simplify this and say that it's talking about the instincts and the just a nice little picture of how, you know, man is caught between the drives and his intelligence. It's not something worthy of you know, the ink that King Solomon spent on these number of verses over here. So let's see if we can understand this here. So again, he says he's saying, you know, Ibn Ezra saying that this is literal. So he's telling you a bit of the facts. So the facts of the case are that you have a city that's small and there are few men in it, and then a great king comes and besieges the city. And inside this small city that's been besieged, there is a man who's poor, but he's wise, and he saves the city. So now he's just setting up the facts. He's telling us the facts of what he now wants to discuss. And the first thing he says is that he is not remembered. No man remembers this poor person. Okay, what's the question?
Why not?
Okay, that's one question. Let's look at it from the perspective of trying to understand why King Solomon's writing this.
What does remembrance have with being wise?
Well, the remembrance is about the other people of the city. It says, "Lo zachar es ish hamiskenhun," and Adam lo zachar, and man does not remember this person. So the lack of recall is a critique on everybody else, not the wise poor man.
So it shows that the people don't value wisdom.
Right, even though he saved the city.
Right.
Very good. Very good. Exactly. That they do not remember him means that they do not value him. What's one of the characteristics of this person, though? When he describes the whole event. When he sets up the facts for us.
Well, he's poor, and maybe the question is, if he's wise, why is he poor?
Okay. Ibn Ezra, I think, actually addresses that, and he says that... He says, this matter is about a wise person who has no bread. He speaks a little bit difficult here. It's hard to understand what his description of the person is. The first thing he says is that he's wise, but he has no food. But he says further that even though his wisdom has not helped him out in this world, I guess to secure a good living for himself, in the majority... He says there are times where his wisdom will be better than kingdoms. Meaning, that's what he says, that this guy was able to come up with a great plan that succeeded over the king that laid a siege on the city. All right. And the way the king set siege on the city, it seemed to be impossible to escape. But this poor, wise person came up with a plan. It worked. But nobody remembers him. But the interesting thing is, he's talking about that he's poor. Well, why can't he say that he's not poor? What's the difference in terms of the story? Then King Solomon goes on and he says in verse 16, he says, I say, and again, look again carefully, I say, now you know that it's King Solomon giving his own opinion. I mean, you could ask a question. If he wrote the whole book, do you have to say that I'm now writing this chapter in the middle of a book? You know the author. His name is stamped right on the cover, right? So you never have a book today where the author now starts chapter 9 and he says, and I am now writing this chapter 2. Right? So why does King Solomon have to do that? This proves my point, that he's trying to let you know that when I don't say the words I say, that means I'm not subscribing to the opinions. I'm merely vocalizing them in order that I can bring them out and we can discuss them. But then when I give my opinion, King Solomon says the words I say, or me. He refers to himself. So you see that this is now his own view. His own view, he says, is what? Because why does he have to say this is now my view? Because he just finished saying that no man remembers this poor person. But no, King Solomon says in the beginning of verse 16, "V'amati ani," but I say, better is wisdom than strength. Because you see that this poor, wise man saved that city from weapons of destruction and a big army. But now look how he ends off his verse. He says, but the wisdom of this poor person is despised, and his words are not even heard. It seems that he's repeating himself, isn't he? Didn't he just say at the end of 15 that no man remembers him? So why does he have to say it again in 16? And then he says a new point. He says that the words of the wise, when spoken pleasantly, they're heard better, and they're more, they penetrate the ear more than the cries of a foolish ruler. What's his message over there? That's 17. And then the last verse again. Better is wisdom than weapons of war, and a single sin could destroy much good. So again, just to reiterate that question, what is that last part there? A single sin destroys much good. What does that have to do with what it's discussing here? Okay, so let it resonate a bit, and we have to sort of put in context to give some sort of a, to categorize what we're discussing here in order to see how these verses will then be, will fit in. But it's always good to see where the matter, the subject matter begins and ends. Let's, you know, just put some brackets, some invisible brackets around these verses so we know it's a self-contained topic. And then we have to see what is it that he's trying to elucidate within this topic. So we have to understand what the topic is, and then what is he trying to do with the topic. So if we could use that as a framework here, you know, let's try to proceed. So he's giving a little bit of a discourse here on how wisdom can be can succeed over might. Right, the pen is mightier than the sword. Right, that's basically if we had to put a heading to this.
Well, the topic is really about the value of wisdom.
Well, that would be too general, because the whole book is about wisdom.
That's true.
So we want to, you know, fine-tune it a bit to see what specifically is he taking up here. So it seems to be within the realm of military. Right, when there is one nation against another. Now let's see how wisdom works out here. He's looking at different aspects of the multifaceted human existence. There's so many angles to it. And here's just one sliver. And it's showing how you could have a situation. But what's the phenomena that he's trying to bring out? What he's trying to bring out something over here. And one point is, as like Cal said, that they, when I was asking the question before, so she pointed out that, you know, the guy is poor. All right? So what was your statement, Cal?
Well, the people didn't value wisdom.
Right. Or you could say they valued something else more.
So is this about the relative value of might versus wisdom, physical strength?
Well, there's something else as well. He threw in here that this person is poor, right? And I asked the question, what is that needed here? Why is that needed? What would have been different if this person who was wise was not poor?
It showed them that the people value wealth more than wisdom.
Very good. Now look at his words, and you're going to love this. Because he says in the beginning of 15, the big king laid a siege on the city, right, in 14. Then it says in 15, and there was found a man who was poor and wise, and he saved the city with his wisdom. But man does not remember this poor person. Notice that he says, that man does not remember the poor person. Does not say the poor wise person. What it describes what the person is, again, he's called poor first, then a wise person. Because that has greater weight in man's eyes, the wealth. So you see what King Solomon is doing is touching on the nerve of a certain value that people have, which is so foolish. This guy saves an entire city, but man does not remember this person who is poor. It doesn't say man doesn't remember this poor wise person, because to them, he's defined by his wealth. That's all he is. The people refer to him as poor, right? Man does not remember this man who is poor. When King Solomon is describing him, he tells clearly what the facts are. He's poor and he's wise. But when the people forget, why do they forget? Because he's poor. So they're looking at the image. Okay? So we see a little bit of the phenomena that he is addressing. Right, and Rezora is writing as well that it would be less amazing if he would not be poor. Right, if he did not be poor, so then they wouldn't push the guy aside. But since the guy is a poor nobody, well, it looks like we're cut off again. Let's hold on until they call back. And this time I wasn't even touching the phone, so I'm not sure what the connection problem is. Okay.
This is very bizarre.
Yeah, listen. Technology is not perfect. But at least I feel good this time. I wasn't even touching the phone, so.
Okay.
I know it wasn't, it's sort of resting over here, so.
Maybe.
Unless it was resting on a button. Could be. I'm not totally off the hook yet. All right, no pun intended there. Okay, so we notice that he puts the fact that the guy is poor because that's part of what he's trying to point out. Now let's go a little further. But he says, but I say that wisdom is greater than might. Meaning, my assessment of this situation, King Solomon says, is let's look at the facts. What was great here? This person's wisdom saved the whole city. Right? However, he contrasts it, right? He repeats it again, that the wisdom of this poor person was despised, and his words weren't even heard. Okay. And Rezora is just asking, could it be teaching of the nonsense of searching for approval? Well, we'll have to see. Let's see how it plays out, Rezora. Let's see what plays out. But now we have a problem. We want to understand, why does King Solomon repeat this fact? He already said at the end of verse 15 that man does not remember this poor person. So we appreciate the fact that King Solomon omitted the word wealthy, poor person. Because now when he was describing the people's reaction from the city, so they're living a foolish life, and they just look at his wealth. So that's why it does not mention their view of this person is purely that he's poor. It doesn't include the appellation that he is a wise person as well. They omit that because that doesn't register. That's like you said, Cal. They don't respect the wisdom. They are more impressed with wealth. So. But King Solomon comes in and says, no, Amarta Ani, I say, to make it clear that this now is his true value system, his position, that better is wisdom than might. But why does he have to repeat the fact that the wisdom of this poor man has been despised and wasn't listened to? See, I think he does that because a stark contrast brings out the point more. So if it's a subtle point, the rabbis will use repetition. But contrast is a very good tool. I say this, but everybody else says that. When you put it that way, then it picks up and it really brings to a point the contrast of the two value systems. So he's trying to show you that you should be valuing wisdom, which was able to be more powerful than the might of the enemy. And then look at the other people. He's giving a backhanded, slap to them, because he's saying, I value this. I value wisdom because over might, because it was more powerful over might. It saved the city from the might of the enemy. Whereas the people in the city despised his wisdom. All right, so that's why he repeats it. It's a method by which you see people doing it as well. Like they hold up, if you're trying to make a comparison, so a person will speak his opinion, he'll tell you about it, but then a very succinct way of making a point is you put up your two hands, and then sort of like, next to each other, like a balancing scale, and you move your one hand, and you say, if you're talking about, the person's comparing where to go shopping. So let's say one store is very far away, but they have better prices. Another store is close, but they're more expensive. So the person has got his two hands out, and he's going, distance or price? Distance, price. So when a person does that, it now pits up the two issues with a stark contrast. That's what he's doing over here. Okay, you see it?
Yes.
Okay.
But I also wondered if you could approach it from another way.
Yeah.
And that's to show how powerful this emotion towards money or wealth can be, to the fact that it blinds you from even seeing the power of wisdom.
Yes. That's true. Yeah, that's a very, very important point, that a person is impressed, but not only the money, it's the person. You see, this man was an Ish Miskain. He was a type of person. It's showing you here how people have respect for status. See, it's not just the wealth here, but it's the person who is wealthy. But this guy is not a person who's wealthy, so we can push him aside. So it's more than just the money. Here he's trying to show you how you have a person that brilliantly saved a city, but since he's not popular, so they're going to, treat him in a very despised way. I was at the funeral of Rabbi Chait's father a couple of weeks ago, and one of the sons, I believe it was Moshe, Chait was talking about an incident where Rabbi Chait's father had seen this great, wise man, but a lot of people didn't know who he was. And he was an elderly wise man from Europe somewhere, and Rabbi Chait's father would always make sure to have him at the house and treat him, and he taught his sons. And this is Rabbi Chait's brother Moshe, who would say that my father always would show us how to treat the wise people, the wise men. And he did that, and he always invited them over. Rabbi Chait's father always had this old wise man over at their house and treated with such dignity. And he says that was one of the main lessons that he saw growing up, what respect to have for the wise. Here is just the opposite. Here it's where people are valuing the social. That's all that's important. He's got a lot of money. He's a powerful person. And unconsciously, they're always, hoping to get some. That's really what's underneath a person who's associates with the rich. That's always a wish. He's not just trying to give the guy honor. I'm friendly enough that then maybe he'll buy me a fancy car. It's just the person's own self-interest or what's motivating it. And the person also feels very important because people treat him that way. And that reality seems to be teaching the person who's got wealth that he could be arrogant. I am more important than everybody else. Now, there is a good. The person should be respected if he was rich, but for the right reasons, because he was able to really harness his energies. And it talks about Rebbe and one other, I'm not sure who it was, Rebbe and Antoninus, I'm not sure who it was, a Gentile or a Roman ruler, and it says by both of them that they never lacked having lettuce or cucumbers on the table year-round. So what are they trying to say? They're trying to show how it was a trait that was a good trait to be able to harness your energies and to procure. You like certain foods, you can do it. And by the fact that they were able to both do it, showed a praise of that ingenuity. So a person has the ingenuity to become successful, so that's something to respect. That's a good thing. God said to Adam and Eve, where he says, go, take over the world, conquer the world. So conquering is an important thing. But of course, it has to be couched in the proper, you know, objective of life. Okay, but here, he's talking about how the wrong view. How since the guy was poor, that was it. That's his whole definition, and they despised him. Okay, so that was Tes Zion, that was 16. Now we move on to verse 17, where he says, another angle, but still related, because you see he talks about a ruler here. We're still talking about in the realm of rulers and people and the subjects. He says, the words of the wise, when spoke pleasantly, are heard. Better than the cries of a foolish ruler. So what is he contrasting here? He's contrasting here. You tell me.
Well, he seems to be contrasting wisdom over foolishness, no matter where the foolishness is coming from.
Right. Meaning, even though it's a king, it's a Moshe. Right? Even though the cries are coming from a ruler, again, he's trying to show you another angle on where you should give credence, what should really be what you value. It should not be the person. Don't look at the packaging. Right? He's bringing it out now.
Rabbi, there also seems to be something between the contrast of using gentle words versus shouts.
Yes, that brings out the point even more. That you might feel that the presentation, and that's something we should look at. A person is exuberant, they're saying something in a certain way. So, wow, there must be something true? No, do not even look at that. I mean, she's showing you with the different areas that man is typically impressed, and King Solomon is saying, don't be impressed with those things that typically you are drawn in by. A person is such a good orator. He uses such poetic and flowery speech. Oh, it's such a pleasure to listen to him. Yeah, but what did he say? So he's saying, don't look at, before this, he said that, look what the wisdom did. Wisdom saved the city. It's more mighty than power. So that's in terms of the objective that it brings about. So that's one way. In terms of assessing a value of something, he's showing you that we are going to assess the value of wisdom on a couple of fronts. The first one is going to be, of course, the results. Look at what wisdom does. It saves a city. It is more valuable than power, because the words of this poor, wise man were able to fight against this king and his army. So now we've assessed the value of wisdom in terms of the results. Right? But now let's also assess in terms of the processes of delivery. Are you going to be impressed with a ruler, with the packaging, who screams out, he cries out, but he's a fool? Do you look at the fact that he's a king, he's a leader, and he cries out? Or are you going to look at the fact that the words are wise, no matter how quiet and delicate they're spoken? So that's what he's doing in 17. You see it? He's not talking about the results. Now he's just talking about where the lures come in that cause a person not to be impressed with the wisdom. Because if a person is looking at the person, if that's who we're respecting, oh, this guy's poor? I don't care if he's a wise man, but he's poor. He's got no social status. I'm not going to listen to him. Now King Solomon is showing you another way that very same emotion is expressed. A person has a position as a leader. So he's not wealthy, like verse 16. Here the person's the ruler, and he cries out, he shouts with such belief in his words. Do we look at that? No, that we also do not look at. Again, what we have to be impressed with is the most, even the quietestly, the softest spoken words that are sensible, that are wise. And also this teaches you that the wise people, the first part of the verse tells you that the wise men speak with in a pleasant way, because they know that it's not anything else that should convince a person other than the content. All right, that's what they say. A word to the wise is sufficient. Say, we make a point, if a person's wise, he'll hear the content, and that's it. So that's another angle he's showing over here. Now, what we have to do is understand this very last verse, which seems to be the most difficult. Because it seems in the beginning of the verse to be continuing with the theme, because he says, better is wisdom than weapons of war, than articles of weaponry. And one sin could ruin a lot of good. The last part doesn't seem to fit in, all right? You see why that's bothering me?
Yep.
Okay.
Can we conclude that the first half of verse 18 is repetitive to make the point?
Is repetitive to make the point what? Which point?
Oh, I mean, up in 16 he says almost exactly the same words.
Right.
So, sometimes you repeat a point because it's important and you want to get it across.
Right, but here that point is now part of, it's the first half of a verse that seems like the second half doesn't belong. So I would wait till we get to see what the second half of the verse is, because maybe then we'll understand why he repeats it. Maybe it's not such a repetition anymore.
Okay. Now, your translation is a single sin. Ours is a single rogue. Is it the action or the person?
Seems to be it's the action.
Okay.
I think there's actually... used by Maimonides to make the point that it's not the number of sins or the number of good deeds that you do that God looks at when he judges you on Yom Kippur, but it's the gravity. And he says that a person could have many, many mitzvahs that he did, many, many righteous things, but he could have one sin that outweighs them all and erases all those sins. I think it's this very verse. Let me just see. Yep, right here. Laws of Repentance 3:2. And he says that there is a sin that it corresponds to many righteous acts, as it says. As it says, one sin destroys much good. Yeah, that's the verse. The Choteh Yabet Tova Harbe. Yep, that's what he's quoting. So Maimonides clearly understands this verse to mean a sin. So what is this doing over here in Qoheles? I mean, let's just understand it clearly as Maimonides understood it. This verse is telling us at the end that one sin can cause a lot of good to be wiped away. Very nice, but what are you doing putting it here when we're in the middle of the lesson of why a city is saved, and what's better? Is it the words of wisdom or the impressive speeches of kings? You know, it seems to be a non sequitur.
Rabbi, when you talk about it just seems like if your basic premise from which you do all of these good deeds is flawed, then it kind of negates the good.
Well, here the guy was poor, but he did the good thing.
When you talked about the gravity of the sin, sort of the, that there are some things that you can do that are maybe not as bad as other things. And it seems to me like it's a foundational thing. If that's flawed, then everything, no matter how good it is, then they will be flawed.
I don't know if I'd say that. You could have a bad foundation and still do, you know, I mean, that's a person who's wicked is able to get back to a good life, so we can't say that since he's wicked right now, his whole foundation is flawed, he could never do anything good. Yeah, we had trouble on this one, and we were working on it yesterday, actually. But what, think about it for another moment, and then I'll tell you what we came up with on this. And by the way, if you want, I have more of an open schedule. We can learn again tomorrow, if you'd like, you know, continue more of Koheles, because there's such a tremendous amount here. So I'd be more than happy, you know, if you have time tomorrow.
I would love to, but I think I have solid conference calls most of the morning and then up through the latter part of the day.
All right, so maybe we'll see. So maybe Tuesday. I'll see how my schedule is going Tuesday. But, you know, feel free to let me know how your schedule is for the week.
Yeah, you know, Cal could set it up and go ahead and just tape it. I could catch the replay.
Well, to me, I don't know if it'll matter tomorrow or Tuesday, so why don't you see what's better for you?
Okay, let me check my schedule.
Yeah, you let me know.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, I admit, I can say that, you know, he's making the statement because it's true, you know, particularly in a military situation, you know, when we say wisdom is better than weapons, but a single mistake can ruin a great deal of good. Yeah, one person screwing up a military operation can cause a lot of death. But why he brings that in right at this point,
he's not talking about doing something wrong in the military tactics. He's just saying that if you have one sin, you can get rid of a lot of good. Well, what's the good he's talking about? Maimonides is basically talking about that a person does a lot of good in life, so now he has merits. Now those merits, when the time of the Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah come, it's weighed whether or not he's going to be written in the book for life for another 12 months. So we're talking about merits in terms of sustaining the person, right? Just so we have it clear what is, according to Maimonides' understanding of this verse. And then, of course, what is he repeating? The fact that wisdom is better than weapons of war. I mean, he said this already. So it's two questions, but I think there's one answer that addresses both. And I believe that answer is like this. He was talking and telling us in these verses that people value status, so that's why they don't remember this man who is poor, even though he's wise, but the poor status is what they looked at. So that's a foolishness. King Solomon comes in and says, no, I value wisdom over might. And he makes the contrast in verse 16 just to really bring the point forward, like we said. So that verse 16 is a verse where he wants to pit up clearly the good, things you should value, and things you shouldn't value. I value wisdom, but people reject and they despise this poor man who is wise. Right? And he says it's the wisdom of the poor man that they despise. Why? Because it's the person that they're looking at. And then he plays up that idea more, but that's all talking about the objective, we said. Wisdom is something which is greater than might, King Solomon says. So when you compare, when we are assessing the value of wisdom, so there's different ways we can assess it. One is in terms of the results that it brings. That was up to this point. That was 16. 15 and 16. And 17 is not talking about the results, but he's saying now in terms of what you should give value to in the process of hearing words. So the delivery is not something which you should give credence to. In terms of the, again, you're giving status to the person. It should be the content itself. So that's more of an integral thing. The first thing was telling us, the first verse was telling us that look at the results. The proof is in the pudding. So of course wisdom is better. It was able to save a whole city. All right, a good plan is much better than just going in, you know, all with all your guns blazing without a good plan. So, I mean, look at King David. He had a couple of stones and a slingshot, took down a giant that was armored with the greatest weapons of war. Right, he aimed it right for the skull, and that's it. A perfect example of where plan outweighs, wisdom outweighs the might. All right? But then it's not only in terms of looking at the results, but in terms of what should be, why should you be looking at it? Why? What's the flaw of these people? The flaw of these people is that they're looking at the person, the packaging. Oh, look at, he's a ruler. He's speaking with great enthusiasm with his voice. So that impresses people. He says, don't do that. The words of the wise, even if they speak quietly, they know that it's the content per se. That's why it's more important. Just look at the content, right? So that's why you're going to have the successes, because you're working with wisdom over here. But now, in the last verse, what he's trying to do is tell you one more thing. He's saying, although better is wisdom than the weapons of war, there's something else which is part of the equation, and that is God's justice. So that's why he says the last verse, 18. It's true, there's planning, and man can do the best planning, and you should use wisdom. But let's not forget that if a person sins or if people sin, so even the best plans are not going to work, because one sin can wipe away much good. So he's now bringing in to this discussion the other side of the coin, which we didn't even touch on yet, which in terms of assessing how to save yourself from a situation, yes, you have to use wisdom. Yes, you should not be looking at how impressive people are, the way they present things, but look at the content. But don't forget that this is only in terms of man versus man. But then you have to realize that God is part of this picture too. And if the people are not worthy, and they have a giant sin on their clothing, so just like Sodom and Gomorrah were wiped out, you can be wiped out too. So you got the best plans and everything, but in order to really speak completely and give the whole picture over here, he has to also tell you that the other much more vital element in terms of determining the success of a city is going to be the righteousness before God. That's why he brings it in. So he's not repeating himself in the beginning of 18 by saying that better is wisdom than the weapons of war. We know that already. He's saying, in other words, like this. Now, although we've said that wisdom is better, there's something else. So he has to bring it in to show you another contrast. He has to sum up and say, now, what we said so far is true, but there's something else which is even more true. And that is, do these people deserve to have God involved? Because up to this point, we're only discussing tactical warfare, man against man. But you could be there, have the best plan and the best wisdom, but if God feels that you should be destroyed because your city is corrupt, that's it. Okay, and Joshua is writing it from Indiana. He wants to know if this now ties into the next verse, which is 10:1. And it could be, because again, the chapters are something which the Gentiles made, so we don't look at the chapters as a break. We have to see if the theme is something which continues. So maybe what we'll do, Josh, think about that, and we'll try to continue this week, and we'll post on the site when we will, or maybe we'll do an email just to let you know if we'll do another class and when it will be. But that's I definitely thought about that, Josh, so it's a good point you're bringing up. Because next verse says that a dead fly can make putrid the perfumer's oil, right? And better is wisdom, more precious is wisdom. Let me see how it says it here. Yakar. How do you have the last verse, Doug? You read that, 10:1?
It flies, teeth are flies of perfumer's oil, a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor.
All right. Or it could be he's going on with another, picking up on his last thing, on his last theme. But do you see how, what he's doing now in 18?
Yes, thank
it's,
you.
That's clear now. Now we see, it seems like to be like an enigma, what is this doing over here? But we spent time, we were really troubled by this, but then we realized, ah, that's what it's talking about. That he's talking about how do we assess the, in terms of, you know, how wisdom works in military and in politics and all, but that's not part of it. That's the problem with Israel today. That they, you know, how do you have God's land without God? There's all these discussions, all these things that they're doing, trying to work out to have the best situation for Israel, but they don't even look at the fact that this land is given to them by God. So it's like they want God's land. It's like a real, the most blatant contradiction. You're talking about Israel and keeping Israel, but where'd you get Israel from? From God. So how can we not observing the Torah? You're not observant. So it's a real contradiction. So the whole element of God and providence and is completely amassed over. It's just an amazing thing to me. But you see that people are so into it. They want to have power. They're running to be prime minister. They've got all these plans and everything. It's just man. They're just so impressed with themselves, and people are impressed with other people. And this becomes the whole barometer as to what road we're going to take. It's just amazing. How blind the whole thing is. All right, any last comments or questions?
I think we're good here. Thank you very much. This is very interesting.
Yeah, it is. All right, so be in touch with me later today, tomorrow. Let me know scheduling, and then maybe we'll take up verse 10:1, you know, Josh's question, and we'll continue. All right?
Sounds good.
All right, then.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
My pleasure, Sean, Cal. All right, a great day to everybody.
You too.
Okay, I'll look out for a call from you or an email, whatever's good for you.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so that wraps it up for today. We go back to the Talk Live page. We'll post. We'll try to have another class this week and continue with this very interesting book of Koheles, Ecclesiastes. All right, so until then, everybody have a good holiday, and we'll look forward to learning together, hopefully within the next day or so, and we'll just post it online. Okay, Joshua, my pleasure. Hannah, JHS, in... I'm not sure that's Netherlands. Rosora, as always, my pleasure. And we'll post this online, so this way if you missed any part of the class, you'll be able to listen to it in its entirety. We'll put it on the audio page and also probably the new postings, so you'll be able to listen to the whole class. All right, a good day to everybody. Take care.